This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you in part by...
With a unique design and construction, DNA Guitars is a clear choice when looking for the all-around guitar. DNA Guitars' recipe for creating perfect instruments is steeped in tradition while looking toward the future. DNA's recessed bridge construction is a five-point contact bridge, a solid brass bridge that is inset into the body, maximizing strength, contact, and string vibration. An incredibly comfortable guitar to play, DNA Guitars molds to your body, and the neck profiles are wonderful to play across. DNA uses an exclusive 100% solderless wiring harness that is designed for guitars with single coil or humbucker setup. Looking for versatility? Look no more. Check out DNA Guitars. Go to dnaguitarcompany.com. Custom guitars handcrafted in the USA. DNA Guitars. Innovation to fuel your inspiration.
And also by...
Hey everybody, Mark Davin from Guitar Radio Show. Have you heard about Lock Knob? LockKnob.com? Lock Knob is a revolutionary product invented by a musician for musicians, solving the long-time problem of lost settings. How many times have you been at a gig or a session only to have to reset all of your settings on your amp or your pedals because they move during transit? You can upgrade your existing knobs on your amp, pedals, mixer, guitar, almost anything with a pot, with an all-aluminum quality-made reusable knob that does more than just look pretty. Never lose your settings again. Lock it down with Lock Knob. Go to LockKnob.com for more.
Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 145 of Guitar Radio Show. Today we've got somebody that I've been following since the mid to late 80s. I learned a lot from him when I was with Wizard Guitars, being involved in research and development for that small fledgling company out of Long Island, New York, back in the day. And we used to watch his videos and hang on every word that he said to learn more about building guitars. We have Mr. Dan Erlewine with us today. And he is a repairman, luthier, author. He works with Stuart McDonald. Has lots of his cool videos, like Dan Erlewine's Guitar Shop, which is a multi-volume video set. And his books that he has had, like Guitar Player's Repair Guide, and he works for Guitar Player Magazine in the past, and also for, and has written for Vintage Guitar, which he currently does now. We get to talk to him a little bit about his past, his present and future, and some of the guitars he's owned over the years, particularly one that we have a really interesting conversation about, which was Mike Bloomfield's Les Paul that he used in the Butterfield Blues Band. He used on the East West record and stuff like that. That Les Paul was originally owned by Dan, and Mike, after nagging and nagging and pleading and begging, Dan actually ended up selling him the guitar. So we talk about that as well. So it's pretty special episode for me, and I think you're going to find it pretty interesting. He is a really great guy and has a lot of great stories. You ready? Let's do it. What do you say? Here's our interview with Dan Erlewine. Guitar Radio Show, guitarradioshow.com. All right, folks, this next guest of ours is a gentleman that I've been following and learning from since 1988, 89, in that area, back when I was involved with Wizard Guitars in New York, and we learned a lot from his videos. We have Mr. Dan Erlewine with us. How are you, Dan?
I'm great. It's nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, and how's things in Athens?
It's pretty nice today.
Yeah.
We're known for humidity, and it's been really hot.
Yeah.
but it's not too bad today. But I'm in my shop, which is air conditioned by necessity.
Yeah, and the climate control.
When do you air this program?
This airs every our show airs every Wednesday. It airs in 11 countries, and we just have to slot when we're going to air you. You're probably going to air in August.
Yeah. That'll be good. That's I'll be around.
All right. Cool. So, you know, I always like to start in the beginning, and you have some very interesting beginnings, because last night I actually got to hear you play guitar back in a band called the Prime Movers from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
You heard that on the internet.
Yes, I did. And you're pretty damn good.
Well, I don't think I was, but... When I hear it, I just think, oh, my God.
Yep,
my brother puts that stuff up.
Michael, right?
Yep.
You know, it's interesting because, well, he's a good harp player, too. Your tone was really interesting, and it was really, I mean, it was in vain with that, you know, Paul Butterfield blues band, that Mike Bloomfield kind of vibe. I mean, you didn't play with that same kind of fire that Bloomfield did, because Bloomfield was off the chain. But you had this real smoothness to you. I really enjoyed it.
Well, Bloomfield was my hero. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
And our band was trying to be a Butterfield band. That's what got me going on that kind of music.
Yeah.
I had liked B.B. King. But I heard about B.B. King from Bloomfield, because he played in Ann Arbor when I was just out of high school. Played in a blues band from Chicago, Mike Bloomfield's Rhythm and Blues Band, and they had Nick Gravenates was playing in the band.
Mm-hmm.
Al Grossman put him there. And then that was the same summer that Al Grossman put Bloomfield with Dylan. But after I had seen Mike Bloomfield at the Michigan Union around 63... I didn't think that much about it, but I went out and started listening to B.B. King, because that's what he said. He goes, if you like this, listen to B.B. King.
Hmm.
So I sure did. But then Bloomfield came to Detroit in 65 with the Butterfield Band and just killed us. It was like, whoa. And that started a love affair with that kind of blues. And then from there, I learned more about Chicago blues. And was lucky enough to meet a lot of people in Chicago and see some bands that, like Little Walter.
Yeah.
We saw Little Walter play. That was awesome.
Wow.
All thanks to Bloomfield and Bob Kester, if you know Bob Kester.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. And it's interesting. I mean, you guys were pretty authentic, I have to say. I mean, you know, even though you were trying to, you know, kind of emulate one kind of band or one kind of sound or whatever, you guys really were very authentic sounding. I mean, when I was listening to it, it moved me, you know.
I'd give that to Michael's harmonica playing.
Yeah.
He could really play the harp. Butterfield said that he sounded like Little Walter.
Wow.
Michael learned how to suck on that harp and get a sound out of it, so that gave us something, a nucleus.
Yeah.
But we were studying it, man. We were listening to everything that everybody was listening to.
Yeah.
Magic Sam, Otis Rush. We were trying, practicing all the time.
If there's a guy who really didn't get a lot of credit for his contributions, was Otis Rush.
Well, he's the greatest.
Yeah.
And among the greatest, they're all equally great at that point, you know?
Yeah.
Otis Rush, my God, I've heard such music from him.
Yeah.
And he's in a wheelchair now. I saw they had Otis Rush Day in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and I saw it on the internet. And he waved at everybody, but he didn't get what he could have gotten. And I think probably at times in his life he was bitter about it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't blame him.
Yeah, oh yeah.
He's a hero, man.
Yeah. So what happened to that Les Paul you were playing back then?
That Les Paul Bloomfield got.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's their last gig in Detroit. They came a bunch, and we'd go in and hear them for weeks. We went to Chicago and heard them at a couple of bars in Chicago. And the last gig they played in Detroit was also Paul Butterfield's birthday. And we had a private session on Sunday when the Living End Bar was closed. And our band went down and played for their band. We got up on stage and played for the Butterfield Band.
Mm-hmm.
and our girlfriends, now our wives, baked a 4-foot harmonica cake. They made a cake and decorated it like a marine band. And we had Paul Butterfield's birthday. It was awesome. And there's Bloomfield had his gold top, Les Paul, at that point, and I had that 59. I didn't care what kind it was, I just wanted Les Paul.
Right.
This is a story people have heard many times, so I won't waste this session with that story. But I went out and got the Les Paul that had been hanging at Herb David's guitar studio where I worked, or used to work at times. And it was gone. And my buddy George Mallory had it. He had just bought it. $125.
Oh, my God.
And I had a Jazzmaster, 1964, and I traded that to him for the Les Paul. He didn't really care. He just wanted a good electric guitar.
Right.
So I got it back, and I played that, and that's the one I was playing. And Bloomfield takes me aside and goes, "Man, I really love that guitar. I think he'd probably seen Clapton's in Europe."
Yeah.
I don't know.
The Dino. Yeah.
He really wanted my guitar. He said, "Man, I want that guitar." And I go, "Oh, I can't. And then a couple months later, when he was out in San Francisco, they started the electric Flyad.
Mm-hmm.
It would be spring. And he called me and said, "Hey, by then, that must have been 66, 67, mm-hmm. is my guess.
Mm-hmm.
It was just before the Summer of Love. It was that summer.
Mm-hmm.
So that spring, he said, "I'll give you my gold top and $100. And I said, "All right." So we switched. He sent me $100 and his gold top. I sent him mine. That was back on the days when you sent by Railway Express. You didn't have UPS.
Right.
So then that summer we went out and played in San Francisco, the Prime Movers, at Mike's request, and we slept in the heliport in San Sausalito where the flag would practice.
Uh-huh.
We'd sleep in there at night and then have to clear out in the day while they practiced. And then they couldn't play an opening at the Fillmore for Cream because Barry Goldberg had been in the hospital and he had just gone into the hospital with some illness, and they couldn't play the gig, and he came over to Sausalito to the practice room, woke us up and said, "You guys are playing at the Fillmore." We go, "Oh no, we're not ready for that." But we did do it. We did go and open for the Cream.
Uh-huh.
Thanks to Bloomfield. And I was out there in the audience wishing that Bloomfield would get up and play with the Cream. But, you know, bands didn't do that.
Yeah.
Cream had a show, but it was amazing. Summer of Love. But now, then Bloomfield had my guitar, and I wanted it back because that's the sound I wanted.
Yeah.
But from the end of that summer, our band broke up, and I went different directions and had lots of guitars.
Yeah.
I went from a Les Paul to a... I went from a gold top. I went from the 59 Les Paul. I had a couple of them and I sold them, but I just had the one I loved. To a gold top, Bloomfield's, I loved that. Then that wasn't the right sound, and I got a Guild Starfire. You know how that goes on a 335. And never went back to a Les Paul again. Till 2001, I think it was, and I bought one of the historic reissue Les Pauls.
Uh-huh.
And they were nice enough to use wood that I sent down to them.
Oh, wow.
Because I wanted it to be just like Bloomfield's.
Yeah, yeah.
As much as possible.
Right.
And I had a cello top from a friend in Michigan that's a violin maker that was big enough and looked just like it. Hard Michigan maple. I took that and a piece of Brazilian rosewood I got from Julius Borges, a great acoustic guitar builder.
Mm-hmm.
An old mahogany from Grand Rapids, and sent it to them, and they made that guitar, and I played it for a while, then sold it.
Huh.
It just wasn't what I wanted anymore.
Wow.
Now I'm on to wanting an Esquire.
So
after this guy's Esquire from Hawaii, man, it's just killing.
Yeah. So that Les Paul that Bloomfield got, is that the Les Paul that Gibson ended up making the VOS from?
Yeah.
Holy
cow. They didn't have that guitar, though. You mean, is that the one they ended up making, the Bloomfield model they made
yeah.
a few years ago?
Yeah.
They made 100 of them or something?
Yeah.
It was that guitar, but they didn't have it. I went down there at that time at their request and took photographs that I had, and we just talked about it.
Right.
They never did come through with giving me a model of that guitar, though. That's always upset me.
Huh.
Yeah. What the heck?
Yeah, really.
I spent 3 or 4 days out of my life.
Yeah.
And went right down there when I needed it, and I never got it.
Yeah, well, we should get a hold of Jimmy Vivino. He'll make that happen.
Yeah. He could. I bet he has the power.
Yeah, I bet he does.
I just think it was a real shame that after what I did and how much it meant to me, that I never got it. But I played a couple of those historics, and they're really nice. I mean, I love those guitars.
Yeah.
I still love Gibson guitars, some of them.
Yeah.
Gibson doesn't make me happy as their corporate structure, but maybe I shouldn't say it on the radio.
No, that's fine. I mean,
I have friends there. I've got friends at Gibson.
Yeah, I had George Gruen on, and he said the same thing.
I don't have a friend that gave me the Les Paul they promised.
Yeah.
And I'm still pissed about that.
Yeah, I don't blame you. If you're going to be involved in the actual, in helping them make the darn thing, they should do something for you.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. I play such weird guitars anyway.
So what year did you actually pick up the instrument in the first place?
Guitar? Yeah. Probably 1960.
Yeah.
That 59-60 Kingston Trio era.
Uh-huh.
When the folk boom was on.
Uh-huh.
My parents were listening to Josh White.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that. They'd also listen to Burl Ives. Kind of hokey, but there were those Martin guitars.
Oh, yeah.
And Burl also played a nylon string guitar. And I'd look at those albums. And in 10th grade, I was playing a ukulele. In 10th grade then, my cousin took me to Detroit to the pawn shops shopping for a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my first real guitar of my own and saw electric guitars that I'd only heard. I never saw an electric guitar or paid any attention to one.
Mm-hmm.
Except on Ricky Nelson's show and James Burton and Elvis and Scotty Moore and all. I loved the look of that. I didn't know what they were, though. I bought an acoustic guitar called a Domino, cheap guitar, painted finish.
Mm-hmm.
Sunburst, white pinstripes with a pinstripe pencil. Very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I took it home. My parents were artists and woodworkers, and I stripped it down so it would look like the Kingston Trios with the natural top. It never did, but it didn't look too bad. So my first acoustic guitar wasn't long before I stripped it and refinished it.
So you were tinkering right from the get-go.
I tinkered all my life because my dad had a wood shop in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was an artist, and they always gave us the stuff to use. So I always had oil paints and charcoals and crayons and pastels and casings, all of this art stuff and easels. And my dad was always making cool stuff in the basement, magic tricks and toys at Christmas. So that would have been what got me going.
Mm-hmm.
In 9th grade wood shop in Ann Arbor. I liked that.
Yeah.
Done art classes. In 10th grade, I went to Ann Arbor High School for a while, and I wanted to get into that machine shop. It just looked interesting.
Like, right.
Those are the days when you were on college prep.
Uh-huh.
Or you weren't. One of the two. Your parents want you on college prep.
Uh-huh.
So I wasn't allowed to go into that metal shop. I would have. I do now.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I've seen you take, you know, have a situation where you're working on something and you're like, well, this needs a tool, but I don't have a tool for this, so I'm going to make the tool. So you'll actually go
ahead.
That's
what we all do. We have to do that. Even less so today because you have companies like Stuart McDonald and others that are making tools,
right,
selling solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, in early 60s, there were two people in Ann Arbor. Herb David's Guitar Studio had just started. I was a year out of high school, and Hoskalo String Shop, violin man.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both on the same street, so that was I hung around those places. I had my Martin fixed at Haskalo's. It was a 0028 coal wood, 1929, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Steel strings, belly bridge, coal Martin, beautiful guitar. I had it in high school. My brother had one too. And it had a pyramid bridge, and it cracked. And the piece just fell right off, and I took it to Haskalo's, and he made it invisible.
Mm-hmm.
I think he put it back on, or else I don't know what he did, but it just amazed me. And then Herb David opened up down the street, went out and started a business teaching guitar and building ouds. Left psychology and became followed his heart. And I worked at Herb's on and off for years. And Herb is retired now.
Mm-hmm.
Probably retired 2 years ago. There was also Paul's Music, which more was the typical band instrument repair. In a music store, they had guitars hanging there, sometimes good guitars, used. I can think of several. But he wouldn't sell any tools. He wouldn't sell any fret wire. He goes, no, that's a, we don't sell fret wire. And people didn't want to tell you anything. There was a trade then. It was, you know, mm-hmm. you keep people out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I wormed my way in at Herb's enough to get in the shop, and that really got me going.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. By 1963, I was taking guitars apart, trying to find out what makes them work.
Right.
Or fix them so they would play better.
So you were really there before the, in many respects, you were there before the boom. Because the boom was 64, 65, and then onward.
Well, I came along after a generation before me that were a bit older, and that was all mostly in New York and out in Berkeley, California.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You'll hear names like John Lundberg and Mark Silver, and on, and they were probably 10 years ahead of me. And remember, that was the folk days, so all those groups traveled from New York through Ann Arbor because of the U of M to Chicago, Denver, and then the West Coast. So they made a tour, all these famous musicians.
Right.
They certainly played at Herb's, and Herb's had a music store, so people like Mel Bay walked in.
Wow.
People like Jesse Fuller.
Mm-hmm.
People like Reverend Gary Davis, they all came to the U of M. And they even had the Folklore Society, and they gave lessons on Saturday. You had to be a Michigan student. I was either in high school or just out. But Mark Silver from Berkeley let me in anyway, which was really nice of him. So you paid a dollar, and you could go up and take a lesson from Reverend Gary Davis.
Uh-huh.
It was group lessons. People sat in the room and got to play his guitar and talk to him, and a slew of people.
Wow.
So that was a huge influence.
Yeah.
Being around all those guitars.
So when 64, 65 happened, and, you know, simultaneously you had, you know, the British invasion, and then you had Bloomfield and Dylan driving a stake through the heart of folk music.
And the Stones.
And then the Stones.
And the Beatles.
And the Beatles.
We had a band, the first band I was in was called the Spiders. That was just out of high school.
Uh-huh.
And we hated the Beatles because of their name, because we had an insect name.
Right.
Before that we ever heard of them.
Right.
But within 6 months after they hit the U.S., we had Beatle boots on. We were playing the frat parties in Ann Arbor.
Sure.
With little outfits, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Peg pants.
Yeah.
But we did, you know, we did all the old rock and roll music in the Spiders.
Did you all of a sudden see that the because the demand for guitars was going crazy, was also the demand for repairs and stuff like that going through the roof as well at that time? Or
that was just growing. Nobody did it.
Yeah.
Herb did it a bit. Herb didn't probably have much more experience than I did, except for age.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a lot of places you could go. And I wasn't too interested in repairing, except for myself at that time, because I was more interested in playing music.
Right.
I mean, I want to make it.
And you were in a pretty fertile music area, too. I mean, Ann Arbor was pretty fertile.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
I flip-flop between blues and folk music and country blues.
And psychedelic.
I took my first flat. I was a finger picker. I learned to play from the Pete Seeger Guitar Guide, the Folk Singer Guitar Guide.
Mm-hmm.
It was a record, and it came with a book. And it started out with Railroad Bill finger picking, and that was a really healthy. You had to read tablature though. That was tough on me. It still isn't a real musical thing to me.
Right.
But that was my first introduction to finger picking. But Clarence White and the Kentucky Colonels came to Ann Arbor in the summer of '64, and I was managing a coffee house, still working at Herb's. Had been in and out of the Navy a very short stint in '63, and I was back to playing music and working at Herb's teaching guitar, wanting to be more in the shop when he'd let me, and doing stuff on my own. And the Colonels played for two weeks stand at the coffee house, and I was flabbergasted. I just go, oh my God, I'd heard bluegrass, and I knew Flat and Scruggs. I'd heard them in '59. Understood Carter family, that's where you started, the Carter pick, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know the Carter strum, I'm
oh,
sure.
Yeah, for sure.
And to hear Clarence Flat pick, and he was the same age as I was, so we would have both been 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear a kid at 20 years old as good as he was, just flabbergasted.
Mm-hmm.
So I switched, I was all about a flat pick, and he turned me on to Doc Watson.
Oh, yeah.
So from there, you go into that genre.
Uh-huh.
And then we start the prime movers, and it's back to electric guitar, like when I first got out of high school. That first guitar I played was a borrowed Harmony Rocket. You know those.
Yep.
So my first band, I was playing a Harmony Rocket, and then I bought a 63 335 at Herb's because I worked there. And that was just so beautiful, but he repossessed it because I didn't keep up the payments. He also repossessed a 53 D28 that I bought that had no finish on it, but it was a killer. And I was looking at Jack Elliott in those days playing a D28.
Uh-huh.
Ramblin' Jack Elliott, you know of him?
Oh, yeah.
They all came through and played in Ann Arbor. I bought that, but Herb repossessed that. And then I got a sitar, and he repossessed that. And it was a good lesson for me. I still love Herb today. I saw him last year, and we went to dinner. He was a good teacher. I'll have to tell him to listen to this.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm just blabbing away.
I love it.
But Clarence White was... the whole band stayed at Herb's house. So we'd go out to dinners with the Kentucky Colonels,
mm-hmm.
Clarence and Roland, Billy Ray, Roger Bush. It was the original Kentucky Colonels, which were quite a band. And Herb was a classical player and trained, and he put a metronome on. He sat Clarence inside and said, start playing. I forget what song it was, something in D. And Clarence started playing, and Herb set it to a metronome, and we went outside, and we talked for several minutes. And we went back inside, and Clarence was still playing right along with the metronome. That always was impressed me.
Yeah, amazing internal clock.
He had it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just telling you part of my life.
Yeah, and this is stuff that I didn't know. I mean, like I said, I learned about the prime movers, and I was like, wow, holy cow, this is amazing.
Yeah. Prime movers seemed like forever. We had a lot of musicians in that band.
Yeah, it was pretty transient there for a little bit.
Boy, they would go through it. Started mm-hmm. with Michael, my cousin Robert on bass. He didn't really play bass very well. He didn't want to play blues. And Spider, too. Spider was our first drummer. Spider hated blues. He was rock and roll and a
mm-hmm.
greaser.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, I don't want to play blues, so he quit. And we got Jim Osterberg.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the band for a year or so, I don't know. And the real prime mover is Jim Osberg, a.k.a. Iggy.
Mm-hmm.
What's the drummer? And part of what I consider the real prime mover is that first year or so.
Yeah.
Playing King clubs, and it was fun. It was a blues band, pretty much.
And it's so funny, too, because there's this one picture of you and James, a.k.a. Iggy, and he's not wearing a shirt. I was like, wow, even then he didn't wear a shirt.
Oh, no, he wasn't wearing any shoes either. If it's us walking down the street, right?
That's pretty
funny. Or is he playing drums without a shirt?
This one was you two walking down the street, and he's not wearing shirts yet. I was like,
and neither of us are wearing shoes. I can't even imagine that today.
No way.
God, my feet would be killing me. That was Ann Arbor in the 60s. It was like a small town then. Nowadays, you won't see that happening.
Yeah. Yeah, did you see bands like? Did you start to see some of the psychedelic stuff coming through, like Amboy Dukes and stuff like that?
Sure, Ted Nugent was one of my early customers.
Yeah,
in fact, we were probably in the same age group. I'm a little older than Ted, but we were both in bands at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and actually had respect for each other. And he was wild, Amboy Dukes.
That was a crazy band.
Yeah, Ted smashes Birdland in a fit on stage, and I pieced it back together from pieces. I wonder if he still has that.
I wonder.
It didn't look very good when it was all done, but
but it played.
It was playable.
That's wild. So
I watched all that Detroit stuff start, MC5.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's really fun. It's interesting because I think in many respects, you know, people talk about how New York, and me being from New York, I understand the birth of punk and everything else and that type of music. But in many respects, you know, back in 67, 68, there was that punk music, that punk sound was coming out of Detroit.
I would think so.
Yeah, MC5 and the Stooges and... yeah, absolutely.
And there was other names of Scott Richard Case, SRC.
Mm-hmm.
What band was Mark Farner in?
Grand Funk Railroad.
Yeah, Grand Funk Railroad. Mm-hmm. Bob Seger.
Yeah.
Right out of Ann Arbor.
For sure.
I gave Bob Seger guitar lessons.
Huh.
I sold him a Gold Top Les Paul.
Wow.
Plus, I loaned him my Lightning Hopkins record, and he never gave it back.
Oh, that's just wrong.
And you can't find it anymore.
Oh, man.
Of course, records, I don't even use records anymore.
I love Lightning Hopkins. Still just so visceral sound. It's amazing.
One of many.
Oh, for sure. So, and then at what point did you say, okay, I'm done? Was it after the Prime Movers were done? You said, that's it, I'm kind of done with the music, and I'm going to concentrate on guitars?
During the Prime Mover days, I was doing more and more guitar stuff, mostly for myself.
Yeah.
I was going through guitars so much that I would spend all day finicking with them.
Mm-hmm.
Just so they'd be in tune to play at night and be all set up and be perfect. And then I'd go out and play shitty anyway. That's the way I felt. I don't anymore. It takes 50 years to learn how to play for a guy like me.
Well, what did Jack Benny say? Jack Benny said about the violin, he says, you got to play 20 years just to stink.
Yeah, that's true. Huh? And I live by that. But after the Prime Movers, my brother Michael and I played for a while as a duet.
Mm-hmm.
Or duo. And that didn't last long. And then I started in the country band, and I was into country.
Hmm.
The Hank Williams kind of country.
Right, honky-tonk.
Honky-tonk.
Yeah.
I joined a band that had a steel player, and he gave me a record to go listen to learn some songs for the next practice. And one of them was... what was that song? Not Remington's Ride, but something like it, by the Texas Troubadours.
Oh, okay.
Ernest Tubbs Band?
Yeah.
And it was Leon Rhodes. And, oh, it was Steel Guitar Rag. And I'd never heard Leon Rhodes, and I can't learn that shit. God, I would try and try. many years later, I became very good friends with Leon Rhodes, and I still am. I need to call him. I hope he's all right. He's getting old, because I'm getting old. He's the greatest, if you know of Leon.
Uh-huh. I mean,
killer guitar.
That's as hard. That's as hard as Jimmy Bryant and Speedy West stuff.
Oh yeah, those were all buddies of Leon's.
Yeah.
They all grew up together. That band played around Detroit in E-Course and pretty tough areas, Wayne. We played at the Town and Country Bar in E-Course like five nights a week. It was a pool hall bar, like eight pool halls, pool
mm-hmm.
tables.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd have two bands each night and they'd alternate. So you kind of learn how to play pool. On the door, it said no knives, no guns, and no leathers, meaning no gangs.
Right.
I made the mistake of taking a black fella from Ethiopia that was visiting in there, and that was not a good thing to do. I felt horrible about that.
Oh, boy.
I just wanted to hear the band. We opened for Hank Williams Jr. there.
Bocephus.
Yeah, and I got to go on his bus. I'd always thought he was a kind of flaky at first, but it changed my mind seeing him live.
Yeah.
When he first started, I thought Hank Williams Jr. did a little too much whining. Well, I'm not as good as my pappy. I remember hearing him at Cobo Hall. And I'm thinking, man, you don't have to do that. You sound killer.
Yeah.
But I love Hank Williams Jr.
Yeah,
I think he under-recognized.
Yeah, I agree. And he's got quite... He got quite a guitar collection.
I'll bet he does.
Yeah.
But he was nice to us and let us on the bus. And, of course, it sounded great. He had one of the original Hank Williams group there. One of the guys, I think it might have been the bass player. No, it was, I think it was Don Helms. Still, he had one of the two players. So it was pretty cool. Some of the Drifting Cowboys were right there.
That's cool.
And Ernest Tubb, then that's where I saw Leon Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
I actually saw him in person. So I went to that kind of country. Now you're getting to 1969 and 1970.
Mm-hmm.
I got married in 69. By then, at that point is when I started my business. Because
mm-hmm.
we got $1,000 from my grandmother. Each of five boys got $1,000 when they got married. That isn't the reason I got married. It's just a fact, because I've been going down to Sears all year thinking, man. And that's when I bought my first drill press and all kinds of tools.
Mm-hmm.
So I was giving lessons outside of Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti at that time. We lived out on a little farm. 69, 70, then we had our first child. I was giving lessons to a guitar player from Ann Arbor named George Bedard. And he should be recognized, and he is in the Midwest. He's the most killer player and singer, and he's based in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just out of high school, and I turned him on to B.B. King and took those records home, and then I played Charlie Christian for him.
Mm.
He took that home, and he, honest to God, came back in 2 weeks, and he was playing Charlie Christian stuff.
Wow.
And I go, I quit. It's true. I kept on playing, but from that moment on, and I've told George this before, that's when I decided I'm going to get more serious about my business.
Mm-hmm.
And gave up. I played in bands, but didn't care if they made it, and didn't even want to do it too often.
Yeah.
Weekends.
Yeah, yeah.
I did that for years. I did that up until I got to Big Rapids when I moved out of Ann Arbor in 75. Went to be a carpenter, got sick of Ann Arbor, sick of the guitar business. My cousin Mark and I had broken up. We had a little business partnership together.
Right.
Ann Arbor was getting too snooty for me to go play and stuff. There was an era when everybody couldn't even play, just thought they would judge bands. Yeah, I don't like them. That guy sucks.
Mm.
So up north, it was fun. You could go to a bar and play. People danced.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any dancing going on too much in the Ann Arbor clubs. It was more like listening.
Yeah.
Except for the Schwaben Inn, where that was... 65-ish when Iggy was in the band. We played the Swamp Banana, and that was kind of dangerous. That was fraternity guys throwing pitchers at each other.
Oh, man.
But the Spiders, man, we played what was called a TG. That's Friday afternoon. You have a party at 3 at the fraternities. We're townies. And then you go play at 3, and they get pretty blasted by 6. And then you come back at 9 and play. So you made pretty good money, and you got to see some really rough stuff go on. They used to have beach parties where they would have trucks dump sand into the windows into the basement of the fraternity house and put made like a beach with blankets umbrellas. Once we played a barn party where they did the same thing with straw, and it ruined our amps.
Oh, I never thought of that.
All that straw and the dust was floating around getting in the amps. That was in the days of the Wurlitzer piano.
Right.
Jay Edwards had a Wurlitzer piano. He was a singer in the band. I'd still like to play with one of those.
I actually took lessons on one.
I like the sound of them in a band.
Yeah, I like when you turn them up and they kind of distort.
Yeah.
That's a great sound.
We played that in the Prime Movers quite a while.
Yeah, that's a great sound.
Then we got a Fender Rhodes.
Mm-hmm. Which tried to do that, but didn't really.
And we got the Hohner Celeste or whatever it was, Twinkie thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then you ended up in Big Rapids?
So I went to Big Rapids in 75 and stayed there for 11 years. I thought I'd be a carpenter and work in a woodworking factory, because the stuff that fascinated me, and I knew people that were friends of my parents that did that.
Mm-hmm.
But I went off to be a carpenter when I got there, and it just wasn't my thing. I got a fiberglass insulation rash.
Oh, man.
First week in August in the hot sun. Yeah. And that thing lasted for 6 months. So I couldn't go to work. I had to wear an occlusive suit at night with this cream all over me. It went away. So during that time, I took my mom's garage, which I had built for her that summer with this carpentry crew, and sort of moved my shop into it. It was an extension to her garage. And I stayed in that little shop for 11 years.
Wow.
And that was my mom would be next door doing her artwork, and I'd be in the second half with my guitar shop, and it was fun.
Wow. That
family.
That was the guitar hospital.
That was a guitar hospital.
Mm.
And in 86, I moved to Athens, Ohio, and Stuart McDonald.
Yeah.
Because that was in 84, I made those videotapes up in Big Rapids.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be something to see today. Because there wasn't anything like that then.
No, there sure wasn't.
Only one camera you could buy that was consumer.
Mm-hmm.
My brother Michael had one.
Mm-hmm.
And he let me use it to make videos. And they helped. I took them in 84. I guess I went to the NAMM show with my videos. I met Stu Mack there.
Yeah.
And they came around and said, man, you ought to come down to Athens. And my dad said, you ought to do that. They were a banjo company, and banjos were waning. And I came here in 86, I would say, and got them into the guitar market.
That's pretty wild, because in 87, I had started a band in New York. And the band was starting to make some noise, and we got an advance from our record deal. And the guy who was taking care of my guitars on the road was also a really good builder, and he was just really. I mean, I wouldn't have this show if it wasn't for him, and because he taught me so much. And he said, you know, I've got some designs. Let's talk about it. And so we did, and we sat and we did bunch of drawings, and then we started to look at the Stu Mack catalog, and we found your videos in there, and we ordered all the videos, and that's what taught him how to make our guitars better. And
those are the old videos.
Yeah, the old ones. Yeah, the old.
Those are hilarious.
They're VHS, all on VHS, and so we were hanging on every word.
I love it. that's wonderful.
You know,
they're so crude,
but they were so informative.
I used to turn those on myself. I made an 8-foot plunge cable, like on a camera, so it would turn on and off, and it would be under my desk.
Uh huh.
And some of them, I was pretty sick with a cold in the middle of the night trying to get those things done because they'd already advertised them.
Oh boy!
To go to the Music Trades magazine,
yeah,
and stuff like that. I had a little press release. Ran into some trouble editing and had to reshoot most of them all over again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I found out upon editing on a $500 Panasonic home editor that what came out looked like it was in a fish tank. It was all blurry.
Uh-huh.
Resolution. My brother Michael's friends that are in the studio business and work with 1-inch film tape said, no, you can't do that. You have to go up. You have to take that and put it on 1-inch tape and then make your copies. So I go, oh, I had to reshoot it because the first round, all those tapes were in camera edit. You couldn't go back.
Right.
If you made a mistake and tried to go back, then you clipped off something that was important.
Oh, man.
If you go through all the tapes, you'd see it. So in the middle of the winter at 2 in the morning, I can remember doing Volume 7, Broken Pegheads. And I just felt horrible, and I looked horrible. And if you see this tape ever, I'm leaning on the bench, and I look at the camera, and I go, hi, it's me again. If they hadn't seen another tape, how would they know who I was? I go, it's me again. And then I lecture them. I go, I hope you appreciate what I'm doing for you. And that's on the live tape.
That's great. I got to go back and look.
It's horrible.
Oh, my God.
There's a lot of tapes have come since then. I'd really like to make more today, but I just don't see it happening.
Right. But there's a lot of stuff on YouTube through Stu Mac, which is cool.
Yeah, but that's not in. I'm not really getting down to brass tacks.
No.
At Stu Mac, we're trying to do a lot in a very quick video.
Right. Well, it's good. I mean, there's a lot of good tips in there. Like, I was watching one last night, and I was like, wow, I've been restringing my pin top, flat top acoustics wrong all along. And then, you know, you were showing
at the bridge end,
yeah, man. Holy cow. I was looking at that. I was like, oh my God, I bet you I'm doing that. And I went and I grabbed I have an Everly Brothers and I love that guitar. And I went and I put a mirror on there and I was like, oh my God, there's the E string.
Stuck on the wood.
Tearing it up.
Is it an original Everly Brothers?
No. No, I wish.
Yeah.
I wish. I love that guitar.
I love all guitars. No doubt. But there's a Gibson and a Martin, of course, are the ones you learn on. There's so many today.
Yeah.
Something about a Gibson, though, is it draws me more than a Martin. And one reason would be because I couldn't afford the Martins.
Yeah.
That would draw me. Mm-hmm. I've owned some good ones and I've played good ones.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have $80,000 plus to put into a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And a 1930s Gibson flat top are quite expensive now, but when I fell into them, they weren't that expensive.
Yeah.
And I got as much sound as I wanted. And then I realized that I like both sounds.
Do you have a favorite model?
Oh, it's hard to say. I think I have an extended shoulder or shoulder problems because I'm not very tall. I'm 5'7".
Mm-hmm. Same here.
And I've been reaching over a big guitar all of my life.
Yeah.
And I used to have a J200.
That's
and all
my
the jumbos.
Favorite. Yeah, I love
too
the
big.
Jumbos. They
it
are.
Extends your shoulder, and I know I'm suffering for it today, so I play small guitars, and I built a guitar for myself that is ergonomically shaped. It's an ugly thing, but I love it.
That's the one that wraps it wraps around you, right? Is that the one?
The what?
The one that wraps around you, kind of?
Doesn't well, sort of. It's one's an electric, one's an acoustic. And the acoustic one, it was just a proof of, they're both proof of concept.
Mm-hmm.
I found a way I can play that my hands don't go to sleep and I can play as much as I want. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't happening 10 years ago.
Right.
So I found a way. I sat around and measured and found exactly what really made me comfortable. Then I built a guitar to fit that.
Mm-hmm.
And what it turns out to be is something that all older people would probably love, because when I play that one, I said it's actually a unit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a three-legged stool, three-legged body. It looks like a Telecaster.
Mm-hmm.
And it holds a shaft, and on the shaft is the guitar. So I don't hold the guitar. I can just play around it.
Oh, wow.
It's wonderful.
That's pretty cool. Are there videos of that on YouTube?
I don't think so. I've got lots of pictures of it, and there was an article about it in Fretboard Journal some years back.
Because
I took it to a GAL convention and gave a demo of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the chair guitar. I call it the rocking chair.
Well, that's cool.
I'll send you a picture of it.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'm going to put it in the show notes. That'd be great.
It's made out of 400-year-old Douglas fir. It's pretty ugly. But, man, it rings.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should talk about the age of the wood and all. And I was going to ask you about the Albert King, about the Lucy. And I was wondering, where the heck do you get 125-year-old black walnut? Where does that come from?
Just out in the woods. I mean, all the farmland around Ann Arbor, somebody cut down a walnut tree and put it in the barn and stored it, stickered it, and left it there forever.
Wow.
Somebody else buys it, or maybe a kid grew up. I'm not sure how it got there. I just know it was really old wood then.
Right.
But there's tons of it. Since then, I find wood everywhere. There's just people cut wood.
Mm-hmm.
I just cut wood last weekend, and I cut down a 150-year-old sycamore tree in my backyard.
Right.
And built a shop where it stood. And we just logged up the wood last weekend. It was a tough job on a wood miser, and we sliced it and quarter sawed it.
Mm-hmm.
Sycamore is like American lacewood. It's pretty stuff. I don't even know what I'll do with it. It was part of my land.
Right.
Well, it takes 2 years before I could use it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It has to sit and season a little bit.
2 years. I can force some of it, little pieces. I want to make some good Tully-style necks out of it.
Uh-huh.
I want to see how it sounds. It sure will be pretty.
Yeah.
So the Albert King wood was old then. I still have enough to make 8 more guitars, maybe.
Holy cow.
I cut it up a long time ago into fine V-shapes. And necks, bodies and necks.
Uh-huh.
And I've made a few in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I saw that video, because I know Bonamassa has the original.
He had it on tour. Steven Seagal owns that.
Oh, he does. Okay, so it was on loan then.
It was on loan.
Oh, okay.
And he just took it along. That was a cool thing to do. And I had just finished one for a guy, so I took it out there and showed it to him.
Yeah, I saw that, and it was, about 2 weeks old at the time, right?
Yeah, probably exactly 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I probably made 6 in the last 12 years. It comes and goes.
Yeah, I bet.
A guy from Norway got a hold of me and asked me if I'd make one. I go, geez. And I still had the wood. I go, I've been carrying that wood around.
Yeah.
In plank form.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, I'll do that. And oddly enough, he ordered another one a year later.
Same one.
It was just like Albert's, but it was for a righty. He's not left-handed.
Right.
And his name was Teddy. Nice man. He flew over and picked up the first one. Couple-year wait, then a lady from Chicago wanted one left-handed. And a couple years later, so probably made 6 by now.
Wow.
I made one for a guy. It wasn't an Albert King. It was just a walnut flying V with blue lights in the fingerboard. That was cool. That's too hard to do.
And was a 9-volt battery powering that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Figuring out how to get the lights to come on down both edges of the fretboard.
Right.
In a dark room, it's pretty, though.
Yeah.
I'm not really a guitar maker. I'm a repairman that makes some guitars because it's fun.
Right.
I just made a guitar for a guy that it's a copy of a guitar I made Jerry Garcia in '71.
Oh, yeah. The Warlock, right?
No, I made him a black walnut body, same wood, maple neck, Stratocaster type guitar.
Oh, okay, yeah. I've seen that one.
There'll be a trade secret at Stu Mac on it.
Okay.
And some guy called me 4 months ago and asked if I would make a tribute guitar. I go, I guess. Because I don't make guitars that often, but it's a fun challenge.
Sure.
And I had a buddy coming from Brazil that's going to stay a couple of months, and I knew I'd have some help.
Right.
So we whipped that together. It's a pretty thing. It's going to be on the cover of the catalog. I think Stu Mac's going to put that guitar and say, look what you can make if you put your mind to it.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I always look forward to getting my catalog to see what new thing that you've either designed or made or talking about. It's always cool. I mean, I have goodness gracious, I have Guitar Player's Repair Guide. I've had the first edition. How to Make Your Electric Guitar Play Great. I have that. And I have
those are all just opinions too.
Yeah, but
I don't claim to be the world's expert.
But it was a great, you know, for somebody who didn't have a clue, you know, I was in a dark room looking for the light switch.
That makes me happy.
You know, and
that's the goal.
Yeah, it really helped a lot. I mean, you know, I learned how to do setups from you, you know, so I can do my own setups. You know,
that's wonderful.
I still suck at neck adjustments, but I just can't.
Oh, come on.
I'm really bad with truss rods. I just can't get a feel for how much it needs to move. And I feel like, am I doing anything? It's kind of weird. But,
well, it depends on how you like to play. And I'm not a big fan of loosening the truss rod and putting relief in the neck.
Right. You say it sucks the tone out of it, right?
To my ear, it does.
Yeah.
Take a really good guitar, adjust it with the neck straight and the truss rod, and play it, and then have a friend stand there and loosen the truss rod and play it, and to me you lose a whole huge amount of tone and dynamic.
Yeah,
it's just what I think, and a lot of other people feel the same way.
Yeah,
not everyone. You could get 100 luthiers together and they'd all have different opinions.
Yeah,
and they could all be right.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess it's all about personal preference, right?
Yep. Yeah. So you need, if you have trouble adjusting your neck, you're probably not turning it very far.
Probably not.
You may not be doing anything.
I probably am not.
Because you're afraid you'll break it.
Yeah, I am.
I am too. That's why I like a neck that really, this Esquire that's here right now, it's just perfect example of a neck that just works.
Yeah.
It's a straight, strong neck. It's a slab board.
Mm-hmm.
It's got me thinking about, because I'm in the midst of making myself a Tele or a couple of them, experimenting with woods, and boy, I sure like the sound of this. I've never been a slab board guy. I've always been a maple neck.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think I'm missing something.
Huh. Interesting.
Well, that's why all these guys have all these different guitars. They know they're all different, and they...
Oh, yeah.
They put their money... I put my money into tools.
Uh-huh, absolutely.
I sold that Les Paul that I had rebuilt, bunches of amps, and other this and that guitars at the Columbus Guitar Show 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago last winter, and I got together about $16,000, and I've just been slowly buying tools that I want.
Mm-hmm.
I can't play all those guitars. And every time I go to use one of my vintage amps, it crackles and pops, and I put $200 into it. I even bought $1,200 very carefully picked worth of electronic equipment. I found a good guy on the internet that was really helpful, and I was going to learn to do amp work, but I gave up on that. That was crazy. You can't do everything.
No, that's true.
So I sold that equipment and never even learned how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Oscilloscopes and cool stuff, and he made me a rig that I could have done Richie Fliegler.
Richie, I haven't heard that name in a while.
He was helping advise me.
Uh-huh. He's a good guy.
I talked to Richie, and he would tell me what I needed or didn't need. But I gave that up and just said, no, I'm getting too old to do that. I'll stick with what I'm good at.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you sure taught me a lot. That's for sure. And my buddy, and my buddy Tony, and we made some pretty cool guitars there from about 88 till about 92.
But we were making some pictures.
I will, absolutely. And we were always going, you know, back then during that time, it was all about the weird shapes and stuff like that too. And but I asked him to make me a. We sat down and conspired on a single mahogany slab, and we made a. We made a Bo Diddley guitar, but it was a gold top, and we didn't age the wood. I mean, this mahogany was pretty wet, and when we first got it, it was really kind of dead. It just had a dead sound. So I put it away, and it sat in a case for about 20 years, and I pulled it out, and all of a sudden the guitar was alive. It was amazing. And
after 20 years?
Yeah.
Well, heck yes.
Yeah, the guitar was alive, and it was interesting.
It'd even be better if it was out of the case, I'll bet.
Probably, yeah. And it was stuck way back in a closet, and it just sat there for years. And then
you still have it?
I do. Yeah, I'll never give it up. It's a great guitar. It has.
Send me a picture.
I will, absolutely. It was. It has one of the. First 100, because we were dealing with Seymour Duncan at the time. It has one of the first of the run of the Pearly Gates pickups that they were making at the time. So I think it's like the first 100 of them, and so that kind of, I don't know if they age or not, but it definitely has a vibe to it.
So, sure, they age.
Yeah.
That's why old humbuckers are so precious. Of course, that's probably because all the music that went through them.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, yeah.
Was your guitar you made, when you say one piece of mahogany, you mean the neck and everything?
No, just one. The body was one slab, and then we threw it was a Stumac neck, three on a side, and it came out great. And I'm sorry now that it has a Kaler in it, but...
That was the thing.
Yeah, it was the thing. It was the thing at the time. You know, one volume, and that was it. It was just a rock and roll machine. And now it sounds. It's funny because now it sounds like a Gretsch. It's kind of weird.
Huh.
Yeah, I'll send you some sound clips too. It's a weird thing, but
I'd
love
it. To hear it.
Yeah, I use it for recording, but it's still heavy as hell. it's like playing a cinder block. It's so heavy. Oh man! So recently I got to play the Bloomfield Tele, and I think it wasn't too long after you had refretted and set it up and got it going, and it went off to auction. I don't know if anybody bought it or not, but I got to play it.
How did you get to play it?
I was at a show, and I went over to the Heritage people. They had it.
Oh, okay.
And I said, "Hey, look, I'm from this show. I'd love to play the instrument. Would you be okay?" They went, "Yeah, sure. Come on." So they brought me behind the tables and they hooked me up. They let me plug it in. I got some pictures of me with it, and you can tell I'm kind of like almost dizzy from it. You know, all that mojo.
That was before it sold.
That was before it sold. Yeah.
It did sell, but it didn't sell for as much as you might have thought it would.
Well, yeah, I mean, what was the opening bid? I think it was like, what was it, 36, something like that? I think. So what did it sell for, do you know?
I probably shouldn't say it on the radio.
Okay.
I'll tell you privately.
Okay, fine.
It wasn't as much as you would hope.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Or as I hoped for the man that owned it, because he could have sure used it.
Yeah.
And then it came back to me.
Oh, really?
And I refretted it.
Oh, okay. So I played it before it got refretted.
You played it before it sold, yeah.
Oh, okay. So you refretted it after it sold.
After it sold, the guy wanted to refret it. I said, okay. And I agreed it could use it for sure.
Yeah, but at the same time.
And I think there's a Stumac video of doing that on the Trade Secret.
There is, actually, yeah. I ran across it last night.
Of the fret job.
Yeah, of the fret job, yeah.
But that was after the fact.
Right.
Then the guy called me and said he had it. And we went back and forth whether he really should do it. Actually, his first request was would I turn it back into a, put the cutaway back.
Oh, that's kind of weird.
Return it to original.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't see what you would gain by that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be made to look like a telly, but then you'd ruin the history of it.
Yeah.
And he thought about it and agreed.
Yeah.
It is what it is, and it sounds so killer.
It does, and it feels
it
feels really good too.
It's got Bloomfield's DNA.
I know, that's what I kept saying. I was like, oh my God, I'm putting my DNA where Bloomfield put his DNA.
He played that on Like a Rolling Stone.
It's crazy.
He played that at Woodstock.
I know, and didn't he play it at Newport too?
Yep, and he played it at, no, I mean the Newport is what I meant.
Yeah.
And he played it at the Living Inn in Detroit the first time I saw Butterfield. He was still playing that telly after that. That was the summer after that.
Right.
So he played it on the first Butterfield album.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That was a telly. That was that telly.
Yeah.
Because he came to Detroit in 65 right after that album came out. And all the telly meant to me was I remember seeing him a lot in the music stores.
Uh-huh.
And liked the look, but I was a Gibson guy.
Right.
And what contact I had with the Telecaster was, it was so hard to control and be good on, because there's nowhere to hide.
Mm-hmm.
You can hide behind humbuckers and even P90s, but that's... with a Telecaster, they're hard to tame.
Yeah.
So I always, and then it was sort of the same with Strats. Strats I could play.
See, and I find Strats, I feel like I'm naked with a Strat, and Tellies I can hide a little bit behind. Not much, but a little bit. That's interesting.
And Gibsons, I like Gretches.
Uh-huh.
On my chair guitar, I put TV Jones pickups on it to get a Gretchy sound.
Yeah.
But now I like Esquires.
So, yeah.
I'm going to make one, and I understand why I like it. It's because it's just one pickup.
Uh-huh.
It sounds great on the bridge. It goes straight out. And very powerful. And then on the neck pickup, they had to find some way to make it more interesting guitar, because it only had one pickup. And the neck one is not much for me, but the middle is just magic.
Yeah.
The middle pickup on an Esquire isn't like having a Tully. It just, I'm going to make one, but I don't know what woods to make it out of.
Hmm.
I've got a piece of Catalpa here. We're selling to Catalpa Bodies at Stumac.
Uh-huh.
And when I first came here in 86, Jay Hostetler, who's in charge of products at Stumac, was just starting to make Catalpa Bodies in our shop. We hadn't made any electric guitar parts. When I got here, we were jigged up to make Catalpa Bodies. It was very hard to machine. Stringy. But I got one of those bodies, and we didn't sell them for long. Too hard to make them, and then people started supplying us with bodies. That's about the time that other companies just made bodies, and you could buy and resell them.
Mm-hmm.
And a stack of those bodies got left out on the loading dock in the garage in the Tobacco Stew Max, and bats pissed on them. Bats nested back there.
Oh, no.
And the whole stack had bat piss on it and stained. And I took one of those and just aired it out because it was free. And the bat piss didn't bother me. The smell went away. And the thing sounded killer.
Huh.
I loaned it to a guy that never gave it back. He went to New York. He was a good player. And he took it to New York to play a tryout gig. And the first night he got to New York, his car was broken into and the Tully was stolen.
Oh, my God.
And I never made him pay me for it. I didn't care.
Yeah.
You can't... Make another one, though, because I have a piece. It sounds like Swamp Ash to me.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's pretty dark.
I'm talking too much.
No, it's fantastic. Are you kidding? This is amazing. I'm in hog heaven.
No, nobody's going to want to hear all this.
Oh yes, they are.
This down.
Oh yes, they are. This you have no idea. My audience is all about this. This is great.
You don't have to edit this down?
Not at all. I rarely edit.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Going back to that Lucy V for a second. I understand. I heard a rumor. Anyway, I don't know if it's true or not. That the guitar was got caught in a tornado and was underwater for 24 hours.
That's what I remember. His equipment trailer turned upside down.
Oh.
In a ditch of water during a rainstorm. So I think it would be a flash flood situation.
Yeah.
And that guitar, I have pictures of that. It was just fell apart. He took it to a man named Rick Hancock down south. It might have been at a place called Pyramid Guitars. I could find out. And Rick put it back together and sent me pictures of it. A picture of Albert and his little repair shop there.
Uh-huh.
And it played again. And then 10 or 12 years ago, something like that, Steven Seagal bought it. And he had his guy fly it out here to get refretted.
Okay.
And actually, I had that guitar. I take it back. Made it in 77. When I moved to Stu Max in 86, we made videos out at the place that's our shop now.
Mm-hmm.
And I made one called Superglue Secrets. And at that time, Albert had called me and sent me his guitar to refurbish, because he was tough on him.
Uh-huh.
And I'm pretty sure it would have been for a fret job.
Uh-huh.
I could find an old video and find out probably somewhere.
Yeah.
And that was before it went underwater.
Oh, okay.
So that was... He sent it here. The bus station's gone now. Downtown Athens had a Greyhound station. And he sent it on a Greyhound. And it was in a Flying V case, wrapped, just simply put into a big onion sack from down south. Like you get onions, like 50 pounds, an 8-pound sack.
Like a burlap bag?
Yeah, it was. Well, no, it was mesh.
Oh, okay.
You could see through it. It wasn't protecting anything. It had a tag on it. It said Albert King. So he wasn't too worried about it, and it came off the bottom of the bus. God. And that went out to the hill and was in Superglue Secrets. And that went back to Albert. Then he came here in 90, about 90 maybe. He played up in Columbus. I got a picture of that, and we went in. My oldest daughter, my wife, and I, and my oldest daughter's girlfriend went in, heard the show, and went backstage and saw Lucy. And Albert was getting a little older at that time, pickup bands. Mm-hmm. He had a good band, but he was tough on bands.
Yeah, I heard that.
Oh, man, he would turn and stare him down and say bad things to him, even.
Yeah.
Just, he needed to have a Booker T. And the MGs.
Yeah, that would have been killer.
And then I think it's when it went underwater.
Okay.
And I hadn't seen it since it went underwater except in pictures.
Right.
Until Steven Seagal bought it and sent it out with his man to get fixed. And actually the guy stayed in town while I did it.
Huh.
And I can't remember when that was. At least 8 years ago or nine.
I mean, I'm amazed that it survived 24 hours underwater. That's just incredible.
Well, it came apart. I've got pictures someplace you can see where all the seams are apart. The fingerboard might have fallen off. The guy did a good job putting it back on.
Yeah.
Because it was wood binding.
Yeah, I mean, you had to dry it out first, right?
Oh, sure.
I mean, how long would that take?
I don't know. I should get a hold of Rick. We talked back then, but it's been a long time.
Yeah.
I was probably a little jealous because I would like to have fixed it myself.
No, sure. Sure.
But since then, I've made a few, and that's been fun.
Yeah. I recently...
I want to make more. If anybody wants one, I would make one.
Yeah. I recently read a really cool article you did in Vintage Guitar. You had gotten hold of an old Hamer 12-string bass.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That was just a little while ago.
Yeah, not long ago at all. A couple of months ago, I guess, right? And I really dig those. I'm a big Hamer fan. I have a bunch. And I think I have like five or six of them. And I never had a 12-string bass, but I love playing them. They're fun. And I always wondered, like, what do you do if something goes wrong with one of these suckers? Because there aren't a lot of folks that repair that type of stuff and wouldn't know where to start.
If that lasts, that'll be good.
Yeah.
If he doesn't have to adjust it too much, that'll work. Otherwise, you'd have to tear it apart.
Yeah.
I was able to adjust the neck, but he won't be able to loosen it probably without that Allen wrench.
Right.
Screw coming loose.
Right, because it's a double.
I did it twice.
It's a double rod, right?
It's a double rod. One's good, and the other one was all screwed up. People adjusting with the wrong wrench.
Stripped out.
Stripped. Yeah, I tapped it.
Right.
Which was a tricky thing to do.
Yeah.
I had no idea for it to work. It was, if this doesn't work, so what? The guy wants me to make him a bass now.
Oh, cool.
I took specs off that, but I doubt I will. I don't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, he might come out here and take a little course. I'm starting a school in my new shop.
Oh, neat.
That's what I want to do, is going to keep working at Stu Mac, but take long weekends and people will come here and specific thing that they have trouble with. You know?
Uh-huh.
A guy can come here in 4 days and learn to fret a guitar.
Right.
Learn how to use the neck jig, which is what I believe in.
Uh-huh. So
or
I see.
I have already had a couple of students. One guy really wanted to know as much as he could about structural repair, and he brought an old L00 acoustic Gibson from the 30s, a black one.
Uh-huh.
With the white pickguard.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had the back off that thing.
Oh, man.
Didn't hurt because he got it back on real nice and clean here. He went out. It had been so poorly repaired, he had to remove the back, which is rare.
Mm-hmm.
And he had balls to do that. And he's coming back, and we're going to finish that job. But that's the kind of student I want, is someone that is at a level they really have something they want to do right, and it's really hard.
Right. Right. Hey, what's your opinion of the old, we were talking about Gibson acoustics before. What's your impression of those old mid-40s Banner Gibsons?
I love them.
Me too.
I got one right here. Listen.
Are you serious? Do you have one right there?
There's an L40, 1942 Gibson LG2 Sunburst. Rare. Mahogany top.
Right. With the banner on it, only a Gibson will do?
Yep, only a Gibson is good enough.
Only Gibson is good enough, that's right. I played a few, and I was like, wow, these are great. And they really weren't that expensive at the time. They were sort of a mid-level guitar at the time.
I mean, back when they were made?
Yeah.
Well, that would have been a fairly deluxe small guitar.
Right.
It would have been. LG2s, you don't see a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
This is a wartime guitar. It doesn't have a truss rod in it.
Right.
Doesn't need one. It has a huge piece of V-shaped hard maple running down that neck. That's its truss rod.
Right.
If you've ever seen them. This one has, you can see a shrink back on the peg head. So that's the mandolin technique.
Mm-hmm.
Hard maple makes it really tough neck. This one needs to have the neck reset, but we just glued all the bridges, got the original bridge fixed, glued that on, moved the saddle because it was in the wrong spot.
Mm-hmm.
Plays in tune. In the war years, remember, all the serious workers were gone.
Right.
And that's when part-time help and new help, many of them women,
right.
Not to not that they didn't do a great job, but they instantly had to take over a job of building guitars. Somebody put this bridge in the wrong spot.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, it's killer.
Yeah, the Rosie, the Riveters.
I love them.
Yeah, I do too. I really like one. I'm considering investing in one. Because I'm seeing them at the shows for, you know, anywhere between, depending on their condition, anywhere between 4 and 8.
LG2s.
Yeah.
Mahogany top, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're talking about the same guitar.
Yeah.
I don't know too much that can beat them, man. I love mahogany.
Mm-hmm. Me too. I'm all about. My Les Pauls are like, it's just this beautiful mahogany thing. You know, I've become a Strat player in the last 8 or 9 years or so, and have, you know, where back in my youth, I was all about Gibson, and I wouldn't even look at a Fender. And now I'm learning how to appreciate both of those worlds and what they can do for me sonically.
They're both wonderful worlds.
They really are.
The Strat's a little longer scale, as you know.
Yeah.
Unless you're playing a big scale Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough to make it hard to play for me. To execute some of what I want to do, I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Always on a Strat.
Mm-hmm.
Stretches a little bit too long.
Yeah. And I still feel like I'm more fluid on a Gibson than I am on a Strat. I still, you know, I feel like the Strat challenges me a lot more.
You probably don't play the Strat as much as you do a Gibson.
Lately I have been, and still, you know, I guess I think because, you know, only 8 or 9 years playing more Strat and 30 years playing, you know, Gibson.
That's it.
Yeah.
Takes 20 years till you stink.
That's
right. What he said?
That's what he said. Absolutely.
My favorite acoustic right now, besides the weird one that I built myself, which I haven't played all summer because it fell off the hanger on the wall and smashed on the lower bout, and I'm in the process of repairing it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm playing a 1937 Kalamazoo K11, and I just love it.
Wow.
You know the K11?
I don't know. Kalamazoo K11?
K11. They make several models. The Collings Guitar Company right now is making what they call the Waterloo. It's a cheap version Gibson patterned after Kalamazoo, the whole idea of a ladder-braced, less expensive student-grade guitar. But those bodies are bigger, like an L00 or an LG2. The K11 is a truncated little squash body, but this, the next full size.
I see it now. I'm looking at it now.
I love this thing. I've had two of them now. One was my buddy's, and that's why I bought one. And I almost bought a second one as a backup, but that's crazy.
And it's like a parlor guitar in many respects.
Only in the body, but that I love because it's easy on my shoulder.
Yeah.
But so is the LG2.
Right.
I just bought a single 017 1934 Martin. And I have a good Martin again, but it needs a neck reset and a bridge re-glued. Otherwise, it's perfect.
Uh-huh.
And it's all a matter of time.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a wall full of guitars, but I still have too many guitars. Things that need work, some killer stuff.
Yeah.
But I got a job to do, you know.
I just had Tom Van Hoos on the show, and what do you think of the Super 400s?
God, I love them.
Yeah. Big guitar, though.
But that's different, you know. You could, if you had it, you could play it when you could do it. I just worked on an L7, which isn't that big, 1949 L7, that I fell in love with the last couple of weeks. And Super 400, I've never owned one. I've played them.
Yeah.
I played Leon Rhodes' 1938 L5. No, Super 4. It's a Super 400, 1938.
Huh.
It's just killer guitar. I went to his house in Nashville and got to play some special things. That's been 12 years ago.
Yeah.
But I love all the big fancy Gibsons. That's why Lucy has a Gibson shaped peg head instead of an arrow.
Okay.
Because Albert wanted, he didn't want the arrow, he wanted it to look like one of the fancy Gibson guitars. He
right.
wanted a binding.
Right.
He wanted his name on it.
Yeah, cool inlay.
And he wanted it fancy.
Well, it was fancy, all right. It was like a Cadillac. It was like an Eldorado.
It wasn't as good as other guitars people have built for him, but it sure had soul, and he sure played the hell out of it.
Oh, he sure did.
I've had it in my hands a few times, and it's like same feeling as Bloomfield's, like a holy grail.
Uh-huh.
When I opened that case on Bloomfield's guitar the first time it came in here, it's just like being in church. I can't describe it.
Uh-huh.
It was like holy. Oh, man. That's Bloomfield's guitar.
That's great. Do you get out to the shows at all, you know, as far as the guitar shows and stuff?
I haven't gone to a NAMM show probably for 6 years.
Uh-huh.
Maybe I'll go again this year. I won a whole bunch of years, 20 years. And it gets old, and then we quit having a booth. Early on, we had a booth at the NAMM show for probably 10, 11 years.
Was that for Stu Mack, you mean?
Yeah. And then we just would send 3 or 4 of us out there every year. And then a couple of times I said, yeah, I'll go. And then I back out, and they get a little annoyed at work. I don't buy them. I don't want to go. And it just, they end up using the ticket for somebody else.
Yeah.
But it's the traveling thing. It's winter time.
Yeah, it's snowing. Tough. Yeah, it's tough in the winter.
I'm not a big flyer anymore.
Yeah.
I'll do it if I have to, but
yeah.
I just don't like to. I've never been to the summer NAMM show.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's not as big or fantastic, but when I first went to a NAMM show, it was in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
At McCormick Place.
Mm-hmm.
The last of them, I think, 84.
Yeah.
And people that I knew at the time said it was like Sodom and Gomorrah. And it was true. They didn't have... Did you ever go to the NAMM show there in Chicago?
No, not in Chicago, no. Always in L.A.
All the partying was done in hotels, so...
Right.
If you wanted to go to Gibson, you went to a hotel, a suite of rooms, and if you were a dealer, you got in, and you could have anything you wanted.
Uh-huh.
If you know what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
Some living. And, I didn't really go to those because I was new to the game.
Yeah.
I can remember one time going up to, when I went to the NAMM shows in California, I wanted to look good, and I got this green blazer.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, that's what all the hotel dicks wore at the Hilton and the Hyatt, green blazers. And I couldn't get into a Gibson party that Ted Nugent was at because they thought I was a narc. It's true.
That's
and
great.
Jay Hostetler said, take that damn jacket off, man. That's what you're... So I went out and stuffed my jacket in a briefcase and got in.
Oh, my God. It was cramping your style.
It was. But the NAMM shows are amazing. I kind of miss them.
Yeah.
And the younger guys, that's Stu Mack goes, and some people that just have to go to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if we have suppliers and people to meet and people we sell to, and I have that feeling of nostalgia while they're gone that first Wednesday, because you go on Wednesday and it's a long 5 days of partying.
Sure.
But by the time Sunday comes and I know they have to get up and come home, I'm glad I didn't go.
Yeah.
But I miss seeing people. And a lot of the people that I met at NAMM shows that are my age probably don't go anymore.
Yeah, I think some of them do. I think Seymour's there and, you know, people
I'd
like that.
I'd like to see Seymour.
Yeah. You know,
maybe I'll go this year.
Yeah. Well,
my wife's never been to one. She might like one, she might hate it. I like Anaheim just because it's so different than anything I know except New York City.
Yeah. The thing that wears on me with the NAMM show is the cacophony, the sound. It's just, it's out of control with sound-wise, so.
But, well, it's out of control. It's just incredible.
Yeah, it's gigantic. Yeah.
My first one in 84, I was so shocked I never called home for 3 days. And my wife ended up calling crying, saying, "What's wrong? What's going on?" That's when I had taken my videotapes there.
Right.
I was just blown away. Just time stood still.
Yeah, you were overwhelmed. Yeah, I was too.
Every morning, I used to be thrilled to watch that band come in. The big red carpet and the band marches through.
Yeah.
I felt like I was in the army or something. And it was so wonderful to get in there as early as you could, because being a vendor, you could come in
right
and walk the show for an hour just when nobody's there.
Yeah. Yeah, I
look at everything pretty quick.
Totally, yeah. I like when it was like first thing in the morning. It was real quiet.
Yeah, now you're talking me into it. Maybe I'll go.
Well, if you do, I would love to meet up with you.
Hey, let's talk about that.
Okay, for sure. Dan, I can't thank you enough for spending the time, taking the time out. I know you're busy and all, but doing this, because this was a thrill for me, and I know for my audience as well.
Well, you can call anytime.
I appreciate that. I may come and visit, and you can show me how to do a neck adjustment.
Okay.
So I won't be afraid.
Are you signing off?
Pretty soon, yeah. We're gonna sign off, and I'm gonna move on to other stuff.
Oh, you should.
But thank you for teaching me. Even though you didn't know you were, thank you for teaching me everything you taught me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show, Mark.
I appreciate it.
Okay.
Let's stay in touch, and we'll speak soon.
Let me know when it's on.
I sure will. I'll send you a link.
So long.
Have a great day. Bye bye.
You too.
Well, there you have it. That was a thrill. It really was such a blast for me to talk to him after, you know, reading about him, reading his books, watching the videos, you know, and learning what I've learned from him. Everything I know how to do on a guitar, pretty much, I learned from him and Tony Anton. And Tony Anton was learning from him. So, yeah, this was really cool. It was a real blast to do. We got to get out of here, but in the meantime, we want to remind you, guitarradioshow.com and guitarradioshow@gmail.com. We've got some cool contests, some giveaways coming up real soon. Checkered pedals. We're going to be giving away one of the coolest phasers I've heard in a long time. It's got a real 70s vibe to it. Like, you know, the sound of the phase on the guitar on Fingerprint File. On the Rolling Stones record Fingerprint File. That's the phase sound that I get out of this thing. And I'll be hooking you guys up with some sound clips and some video as well from this. And it's from Checkered Pedals. And I think you're going to really dig that. That's coming up really soon in the month of October. So I'm psyched. Hey, we got to go. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Keep on playing, and please buy it. Don't steal it. We'll see you on the next episode of Guitar Radio Show. Peace.
Now everybody say, "F you, Ed."
I like this crowd already.
GRS Production.
New episodes of Guitar Radio Show air every Wednesday on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podbay, Player FM, Podomatic, and of course on guitarradioshow.com.